Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. To most people, YouTube has become the place to go for how-to videos, for product reviews from experts and ordinary consumers, for the musings of ordinary people on myriad topics. So many people use YouTube that 1 billion hours of video are consumed from the site each day, making it the second most frequented website on Earth and the world's second most popular search engine after Google, which, of course, is YouTube's parent company. But there is also a dark side to the content to be found on the platform, which often contains violence, and YouTube has given conspiracy theorists and others a place from which they can rise to stardom. That has people concerned, and some, including our guest this hour, believe that YouTube doesn't do enough to police its more extremist content. Mark Bergen writes about the business of technology for Bloomberg Technology and for Business Week. Previously, he did the same for lots of other publications, and his coverage of Google and YouTube has won a number of awards. Now, amidst threats to democracy around the world, he's written a book exploring the power of the platform. Like, Comment, Subscribe: Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination. And Mark Bergen joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I have to say that I'm one of those people that consumes at least one YouTube video a day. I go there at least once a day to see something. And if I don't go there, I'm sent there by some other app that I'm looking at, and it has a link to click on the thing that I'm looking at. But I was completely unaware of this dark side that you reference. How pervasive is it, and what kind of content are we talking about?
That's impressive that you can only keep yourself to one a day.
I didn't say I kept myself to one. At least one.
I see, at least one. I think it's sort of, you hit on a really interesting, I think, difference between, say, YouTube and Facebook, which has had a lot of scrutiny for these issues, in part because, you know, most people use YouTube as sort of a utility. They go to maybe an archival video or a how-to instructional. It's sort of like Google. It's very functional. And they don't use it in the same way they say Facebook, where you might see a relative or an old college friend sort of ranting about something political. But that being said, that certainly exists on YouTube. I mean, I think, you know, in the almost since day one, the company sort of, the premise was that their motto was broadcast yourself. And it was giving the world an ability to publish a video online, which was pretty radical at the time. And then YouTube was the first company to actually pay people at scale to do so. And so pretty early on, they had to deal with, you know, their first issue was the company outlawed pornography and graphic sex. And so they had to stamp out that, and then also kind of define that in the gray areas. And then dealing with what is hate speech, what is harassment, what is incitement to violence. In particular, as you mentioned, they've in the past several years dealt with this relatively new phenomenon of defining misinformation and what is truth. And YouTube has also dealt with, I think, in a way that some of its competitors have not, of it's just the world's most popular kids entertainment service. And so it's dealt with really traumatizing and disturbing and sometimes certainly videos that parents and regulators don't approve of.
There's an enormous amount, an unfathomable amount of video content available, and more is coming literally every second of every day being uploaded to the platform by ordinary individuals. How much would you say, percentage-wise, how much of it would you say is this content that we would like to not have in our midst?
Percentage-wise, it's the thing about YouTube is something can be very small percentage-wise and still be rather big. So the company has a habit of sharing figures without the denominator. So they'll say, you know, we took down to tens of thousands of videos for violating our rules about violent extremism, and then we took down a certain percentage of them. But then you have no sense of like the actual scale. You have no sense of how many videos that is.
relative to the rest of YouTube. So I think it is according to the company's numbers, and outside researchers have verified this to a certain extent, it is a relatively small percentage. I think sometimes like the really extreme, what they categorize as violent extremism for a long time. A few years ago, YouTube had a problem with actual beheading videos on the platform like that. They have their software and machine systems have basically virtually made that impossible to, they don't, those videos don't live on the internet very long. And so less than 1%, but still in relative terms, that is, in YouTube has just a huge volume of video. That's a big number.
You mentioned the beheading video. I think the first video that they became aware of that we have a problem here. It was a hanging, a human being hanging in the woods someplace in Japan, if I'm not mistaken about that. And the YouTube staff coined a phrase for these kinds of videos. They call it nightmare fuel. Would you say that they actually search out those videos? Do they have a team? I know they have algorithms, but do they have a team of human beings searching these things out and getting them off the platform?
Sure. I mean, in that particular instance, that was a video uploaded by Logan Paul, who was one of the biggest YouTubers in the world. So this was, you didn't really have to search for that. It became at one point one of the like most trending videos on the site. But that was sort of an outlier. He had gone to this forest in Japan and shot this video and uploaded it of a man hanging and blurred out the face, but it thinking it was sort of the appropriate thing to do, but took the video down and clearly it wasn't. So yes, they have teams of people that and have had since relatively early the company that content moderators, you know, starting about 5 years ago, YouTube and Google, its parent company, decided that they didn't have enough, they weren't sufficient people staffed doing this. So they hired a lot of outside contractors. And so that's primarily, they don't share the number of people that do this, but these aren't people that are working for companies that aren't YouTube. And they do this in places like India and Philippines and Dublin. And it's sort of around the clock teams of people that are screening this footage.
I know that they have an impact because I have seen certain content providers who have been suspended, shall we say, for a period of time. Mm-hmm. And they come back and they explain why they haven't produced any new videos. And they talk about having been told that they have violated the content regulations, and so they were slapped on the wrist and allowed to return. But now they're amending what they do because they can't do what they did before. So clearly they are looking at this and they are policing this. If they're that affected with ordinary people who sometimes step over the line, could you say that they are just as vigilant on those who really step over the line?
Yeah, I think, I mean, certainly things have changed a lot. You know, the book gets into the history of and some of the crises that they faced and the reasons why they had to change their rules and put in like this new policing. And they've actually, the company executives have used this metaphor of like, we built this sort of town and it became overnight this metropolis, and we didn't have an actual big enough police force or like sewage system or infrastructure, right? And I think that holds a little bit. You know, the book talks about how there are people early on in the company that felt like they had a police force in place, and then Google like grew YouTube so quickly that the resources weren't there. So I think to answer your question, yes, they certainly have become more willing to, especially since the pandemic, to address health misinformation, to address videos around the violence now around the election, the U.S. election. They continue to struggle with how to write those rules, and then more importantly, how to enforce them across millions of videos and hundreds of countries.
Given that they have these rules and they have police, or they have people policing it, and they have algorithms also looking out for this, and I guess the algorithms work on picture content, they can discern from the video content what they're looking at, what these algorithms are looking at. Is it easy to find this stuff? Would you stumble upon it? They can't advertise it because they would be in violation of the rules, and they'd be pointing themselves out to the very people who are policing their content. So how would I run across this unsavory content? Just by doing a search within their own search field, or how do people find it?
How does people inside YouTube find it, or just regular
how do ordinary people find it? Because if there are people out there with conspiracy theories,
right,
which clearly there are, and clearly they've had an impact in our politics here and around the world, how do you find them?
Yeah, I think, I mean, let's take a one that's sort of somewhat benign, but was very popular on YouTube, flat Earth theories. You've heard of this, right?
Yes.
People that deny the roundness of the globe. And it came up on YouTube, and I hesitate to say very popular. It wasn't like it was the most, you know, there's still YouTube is like primarily music videos and gaming and kids content, but it was sizable enough. You know, a majority of the views that over 70% companies share the stat of the views on the site come from its recommendation engine. So people are largely finding it, you know, if you're looking at a desktop computer, it's the right rail on the side of the recommended videos, or if you're watching on your phone, it's a sort of the very next video that it tees up for you.
Right.
And that has become, you know, the company's tactic since 2019 was, okay, certain topics we're going to treat as borderline, the term. And so we're just not going to recommend these videos. And Flat Earth is one that they say they if anyone touches on Flat Earth conspiracies, they don't recommend that. And so that's a powerful tool, and they don't put it, it's harder to find in search on YouTube. And it's, so it's not served up basically. And I think it's a way of saying like the company is not promoting it, because that, you know, YouTube is a media programmer by algorithms and largely by its recommendation engine. And so this is their way of saying, okay, we're going to have no part, even if the video doesn't break our rules and we don't want to, we're not going to take it down, but we're going to have no part in promoting it. And so it becomes harder to find.
All of these social media platforms are instances where technology has outpaced regulation. And I don't know how strictly YouTube is self-regulated, nor do I know how strictly it is regulated by our government, if at all. I know that the European Union has set up their own set of rules for things like this. Facebook and Twitter have come under investigation here and have been the victims of congressional hearings, etc. Has YouTube faced any of that? And if not, why not? And should they?
They face it in part. I mean, I think it's really interesting that a lot of some of these congressional hearings have brought in Google, which is YouTube's parent. Google has a host of other issues unrelated to sort of social media, right? Like it's under antitrust investigation. It's always privacy is a big concern. Republicans have called it the platform for political bias in search or on YouTube. So in some sense, YouTube gets less scrutiny, at least in like the Capitol Hill, and I think sometimes in the press too. YouTube is the one big tech platform that has been regulated on children's privacy. The Federal Trade Commission sued YouTube in 2019, and it's had a pretty big effect in changing the way that YouTube operates for children's content, which is a huge portion of the site. So yes and no. And I think that children's content is the most interesting one, and one where the government actually has stepped in.
YouTube, Google says that they are not a publisher, they are a pass-through. In other words, you can use their search engine to search any topic in the world, and it will send you links to those topics. They're not publishing it, they're not recommending it. It's just, well, maybe they are because of the way the algorithms work. But YouTube is a little different in that it, although it does not create its own content, it provides a platform for it, and it does curate it to a certain degree. So do they have, I have 30 seconds here, do they have more of a responsibility than Google?
There's certainly arguments, and I think politicians are looking at that, yes. And treating it much more like a media platform, like treating it more like broadcast TV.
When we come back, we'll talk more about the beginnings of YouTube, how it all started and how it's changed since Google got involved, with Mark Bergen. Like, comment, subscribe is the name of his book. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Mark Bergen, who writes on the business of technology for Business Week and Bloomberg News and other platforms. He's also the author of Like, Comment, Subscribe, Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise, to world domination. And it is arguable that YouTube has become a major force in media here and around the world. But let's go back to the beginnings when it wasn't anything at all, really. It was its creators are three PayPal alums, Chad Hurley, Steve Chen, and is it Jawed Karim? Why did they start YouTube, and what did they intend for it to be?
This was in 2005, and at like the onset of what we call Web 2.0 or user-generated content. Like the internet was transforming from a really passive place where people just went on and like consumed and scrolled to people were blogging. Like MySpace was really popular then. Facebook had just started the year before. Flickr was a photo sharing app. So there was a sense that the three of them really wanted to get in. There was a huge business opportunity here for unlocking this major potential of having people actually contribute to the internet. And they knew that they wanted to solve this video problem. So back then there were some online video sites. It was pretty clunky. Sometimes you had to pay money. You had to watch them. I think what was critical to YouTube success is a lot of the existing online video sites, then you had to watch on the particular site. You couldn't watch like YouTube's gift is you can embed the files, video files, everywhere else on the internet. Initially, they actually thought that the only reason people were going to want to upload or watch amateur footage was for dating. And so they considered positioning it as a dating site. They were really inspired by this crude website at the time called Hot or Not, which was actually like a similar inspiration to Facebook. Believe it or not, the two of the most important media internet properties of the 21st century were basically started by young 20-somethings that thought that dating would be the only way that people would want to engage. I think pretty quickly they figured out that obviously there was a much broader interest, and they started to, they were kind of what we now call creators and YouTubers, but back then they were just people experimenting with this new video form. And started kind of using it, I think, in ways that the company just like never really anticipated.
When you start something like YouTube, video takes an enormous amount of server space, it seems to me, particularly back in the day before they had all these things that crunch them down to smaller sizes of video files. Where did they get the money to have the server space required for anybody uploading anything at any time and then downloading it or watching it live, streaming it off their servers? How did they find the money for that?
Yeah, Steve Chen was one of the three founders and one of the technical founders and maxed out his credit card a bunch just buying for these like big U-racks to host a server space. Mm-hmm. They had, I think their initial sort of financial savior came in from Sequoia Capital, which is a venture capital firm in the Valley, and one that actually backed Google and knew them through the PayPal network. So the Sequoia partner that invested had also worked at PayPal. And this was a PayPal sort of infamous for being a tight knit group of mostly men that went on to start LinkedIn and SpaceX and Yelp and YouTube came out of that. And that sort of led to more financial investments. And then, I mean, even they were not profitable by the time that Google stepped in, only about 18 months later, and paid at the time a massive amount, well, like more than $1.5 billion.
Yeah, $1.65 billion. Unbelievable.
There's a line I have in the book that like one of the bankers who worked on that said, like, you know, Google's pitch to the shareholders is like, the good news is it doesn't make any money. And then the bad news is you've never heard of it.
And Google had already begun to step into that video sharing arena. Did they buy them because they looked at YouTube and thought, well, they have a better platform, they have a better mechanism for this, and we don't have to spend money on developing ours? Or did they just want to squash the competition?
If there's anyone in Google listening, I think they don't like squash the competition. I think that they had Google Video, and I didn't know the extent of this before researching the book. Yeah, it was they were trying to compete with. They initially started as sort of like a cable box replacement, and then turned to amateur video, and YouTube was clearly beating them and had like a finger on the pulse of youth culture that Google Video never did. And so there is a an expression in Silicon Valley. It's like build or buy, and if you can't build it, you buy it. And so I think they saw YouTube also not just as this really fascinating media property, like this really popular trend with young people, but they saw it. They saw the data on search. And they knew people were going to YouTube to search for things. And so Google is chiefly concerned with another company in a garage, which YouTube was starting in a garage, replacing them as the king of search. Yeah.
Just like a television network, you have to promote your content to get people to be interested enough to tune in. And they did the same thing at YouTube, at least initially. They had community managers or curators who would look at the content and put it on the front page of the website to encourage you to look at it. And I guess that created an appetite for what came after that. And then they transitioned into this algorithm kind of thing that pushes things. I know it looks at what you saw before and makes you see more of the same because they know you are interested in that. What kind of impact has the use of algorithms to encourage people to see things that they might not have searched for had on both YouTube and on its creators?
Yeah, I thought this was one of my favorite parts that I learned about the book is I didn't know that. Actually, they actually had a team picking the curating the homepage early on. Certainly, I remember when I first remember stumbling upon YouTube. And part of this was just the software was not really mature enough to be able to pick videos that people really wanted to watch. I think, the team in some, they were kind of tastemakers in a way, they were able to pick out these obscure YouTube creators and kind of overnight turn them into massive success. They kind of launched a lot of careers in that way. There were people inside YouTube that felt like the premise of YouTube was, we always talk about how there's no gatekeeper on YouTube, right? There's no Hollywood producer or agent or director that's picking out the talent. And it is just you post it up into the world, and then the audience kind of determines if it's popular or not. And so that was one of the reasons. The other reason was financial, right? Like YouTube determined that, we can just, if we have software pick the videos, that's cheaper than having people do it. And certainly as they were expanding around the globe, they didn't want to set up teams to pick videos in the UK and India and Brazil.
But having been in broadcasting for all of my entire life and knowing what goes on behind the scenes to encourage people to watch or listen. And when they find out, I'm talking about commercial broadcasting now, not public broadcasting, but when they find out what works, they want more of the same. The people on the air to produce more of the same. So if content creators, which are ordinary human beings, some of whom are making a magnificent living producing YouTube content, when they come to they look at the statistics that YouTube provides them behind the scenes. When they look at that, when they look at what the algorithms are doing to push videos of certain types to certain people a certain number of times, do they then alter what they are doing to respond to clickbait?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think, and not just to respond to clickbait, but to respond to, YouTube will say, Our algorithm is just the audience, which I don't think is entirely true. But it is the history of the platform is, if you're an online creator, you're trying to sift out and read the tea leaves of what's trending and where's the audience moving, because fame on YouTube is very fleeting, and so there have been a bunch of trends and sometimes they went into the very bizarre. I'll just mention one that for a while, about 6 years ago, there was this kind of vaudevillian trend of people dressing up as superheroes and Spider-Man and Elsa, and then having sort of this world of Spider-Man and Elsa appear together. And for some reason, that was just a magic formula that really worked. And so you saw all these YouTubers just jump on this. And start to make these same sort of videos, hoping they could also ride this wave.
And are you YouTube has created stars. You write about Justin Bieber, who got his start because his mother made him post a song on YouTube and a record executive saw it, and the rest is history. But there are other people. We've had some YouTube people on this program because they have areas of expertise that we wanted to pick their brains about. One of them lives here, the guy who produces I-1 Tesla videos. Joel and Leah, who are those two Brits out of Great Britain, came through Charlotte a month or two ago on their American tour, and they're YouTube stars. Was that the intent? Did the creators of YouTube ever think that the people who provided content, ordinary people, would become well-known and would make lots of money, many of them? Not all,
I think,
of them, but many of them.
North Carolina also has Mr. Beast, who's the biggest YouTuber in the world right now.
Okay.
Did they know? They did not know that would be, I think there was a, they added, you know, there's this function everyone's sort of familiar with now, like subscribers, right? You can subscribe to, which is sort of, it's like buying, you know, subscribing to a magazine, except it's just, it's free. It just takes, it's clicking a button. I talked to people who were there working at the company, like no idea even that someone would have a million subscribers, let alone 100 million. And now you have multiple accounts with that number. I mean, you know, what's really fascinating to me, and I think is a really interesting like business story, is that YouTube was and did birth this what we call the creator economy. They were the first platform to share revenue with online producers and kind of create all sorts of new businesses. But for a long time, the YouTube's business teams didn't think that was their pathway to profitability. It was, why would advertisers want to sponsor, you know, for a long time, the site was kind of like dogs on skateboards was the shorthand for YouTube. Or why would they want these amateur stars, right? Like YouTube thought their goal was to get conventional TV and movie onto YouTube, because that was what they thought, the only reason people and advertisers would fork over money. It wasn't really until around 2014, 2015, where the company realized that they have stars and celebrities right there in-house, basically, and attempted, and with some success, I think, to turn their YouTubers into massive properties right there and make them the vehicles for profitability.
Not everybody who has a YouTube channel, and that's what they're called. You can have more than one channel if you are a content creator, and it can be dedicated to various different topics of interest that interest you and that you have an area of expertise in or not. There's no curating of that kind of experience level. But most of these people, I would assume, don't post their videos with the idea that they're going to become rich. But some people do. I mean, some of these people are making in the millions of dollars a year. Talk about how that works. How do you get paid?
So the primary function, the way that YouTube has made, YouTubers have made money for over a decade now, is just, you know, every time you watch a YouTube video, a lot of them, you'll probably be interrupted by what's called a pre-roll ad at the very beginning. Sometimes now increasingly...
Which I never let finish. I always push the button and skip the ad. So
That's been a really fascinating, just a quick aside. Yeah, YouTube invented this formula or this format that advertisers only pay when you don't click that skip ahead button. So clearly there are enough people that are not like you that are watching the entirety of the ads. I think that's forced commercial, like YouTube commercial, to be kind of innovative and catchy in some ways. I think that a lot of children probably don't skip ahead, and they have a big audience that might not be at reading age. But so yeah, every time that there's an ad that plays and people don't skip or there's just an ad that appears on the site, YouTube keeps roughly 45% of that dollar that the advertiser gives, and then gives the remaining 55% to the video producer, which doesn't, it includes the sort of regular, you know, if you or I were to start a YouTube channel, but it also includes Taylor Swift's record label. And it includes ABC, right? Jimmy Kimmel Late Night TV is very popular on YouTube. So the company often talks about how much money they give to the creator economy. And I think it's important for people to realize they've never disclosed how much of that actually goes to what we think of as sort of online independent creators and how much of it goes to the media industry and record labels.
In addition to the commercials that they pre-roll, in other words, before you get to see the video you've chosen to watch, they roll a commercial. Sometimes you can skip it, sometimes you can't. But also, if the video is long enough, mm-hmm. they will interrupt the video with another commercial or two or three or four or five. That's YouTube doing that. But then some of these content providers have their own sponsors that are inside the content. Mm-hmm. Do they get to keep all of that money that they're generating, or do they have to give some of that to YouTube?
YouTube started to kind of tap that money now with, this is not just if you're promoting something in a video, my understanding, you as a creator can keep that or work that business deal out independently. But mm-hmm. there are tools now for like selling merchandise on the site that YouTube will take a commission of. And a lot of this was, the book goes into detail about how they had a huge crisis 5 years ago where their advertisers boycotted the site over inappropriate videos. And one of the consequences of that is YouTube tightened the rules and made it a little bit harder to make advertising money. And so you saw a lot of YouTubers turn into things like sponsor deals or trying to sell merchandise, or they've had features now where you can kind of give fans can like tip creators. These are things I think that the company is increasingly moving into, in part because the one area where they're being regulated a little bit and restricted is all on their like very profitable targeted advertising business.
So about 18 months into YouTube's existence, Google comes along, buys them for $1.65 billion. That had to have looked crazy to a lot of people back then, because I'm sure they weren't making anything. They were losing money. They weren't making mm-hmm. money at all. What are they making now? What does YouTube generate for Google in an average year?
The 2021, they made close to $29 billion in advertising revenue. And what they don't share is how much... they have a subscription service, right? A YouTube Premium, and they have a TV over the top service, YouTube TV. They don't share financial figures for that, and importantly, Google does not share how much YouTube's costs. They don't share any costs for YouTube, so we don't have a sense about margins. But that $29 billion is remarkable. The earliest data we have from YouTube it was 2017. They made $8 billion in advertising. So if you're an investor or you're on Wall Street, you're very happy with YouTube's progress in the past 5 years.
A couple more questions about how people make money on this. I don't know why I'm focused on this, but I am, because I was surprised to learn that some of these people are really tunning it, and I mean tunning it. We'll talk about that when we come back and more with our guest, Mark Bergen. His book is called Like, Comment, Subscribe. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Mark Bergen, our guest. He writes for Business Week. He's also written the book Like, Comment, Subscribe about YouTube. Some of the contributors to YouTube, the content creators, make nickels and dimes or nothing at all, as a matter of fact. Others have become millionaires. I mean, they make tens of millions of dollars a year on this. The level of compensation, I guess, is based on the number of subscribers that people they have that subscribe button. That's why the book is called Like, Comment, Subscribe. They have the like button, they have the comment section, and you can subscribe to get future episodes of whatever content you've been watching. So it's based on that. I guess it's also based on what? Ads, how much money Google can sell the ad for on your channel. Is it like a television station where if there are more viewers, they can charge more?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's similar to that. There's an ad rate card and there are different, there's a variety of different rates. And so if some YouTubers will get better ad rates than others, a lot of this is pretty opaque. Like there's no, some YouTubers are sort of like more ad friendly, right? Like they have like PG material and have a cleaner record. They have they have better relationship, I think, with the company and with advertising partners. And so there's some that are on that track. Google has some a premium tier that's mostly based on popularity. I mean, the key metric for the company in everything, in the way that not just their payment structure, but like their way that they for their search and recommendation is what they call watch time. So it's like not just views, but keeping people engaged and getting the most hours of watching. And that's the primary metric that's correlated with how successful you're going to be.
In the beginning, most of these videos, as you said, were amateur videos, literally taken off people's phones and just plucked onto the plopped down on the onto the web with little production values. Some of these other videos today, though, are full-blown television productions of network quality, which require equipment and editing and time. And it becomes, for these content creators, unless they have a staff, a full-time job to produce these. Is that the expectation now of most viewers, that these things be polished?
You know, I think there's always this really interesting tension between that there is an expectation. You talk to like a lot of YouTube creators that feel this in one way, they have to compete and they want more production and pizzazz, and they're competing on YouTube with TV networks that are basically just like taking their stuff from TV and putting it on YouTube and have a lot of money. You know, there are YouTubers with, you know, big production companies, and they have dozens of staff members and editors. And at the same time, now there's always a sense that sometimes the like the more say lo-fi or like intimate, you're like bedroom vlogging sometimes still has a lot of appeal, in part because like a lot of YouTube success is these relationships that the creators have with their fans. The fans kind of think that they know them. And so the videos where sometimes you're just like in a room talking to fans, or like much more intimate, those tend to do pretty well and they're cheaper. Mm-hmm. What YouTube is now competing with is TikTok, which is, you know, a lot of YouTubers make videos with cameras and lights and kind of a whole to-do. TikTok is successful in part because it's very easy compared to YouTube to just upload a video from your phone. And so I think they're now, you know, creators are kind of in this torn in this direction between production value and then kind of cheap and quantity on the other side that is competing with TikTok.
What about that? Because the audience for these websites seems to be fairly fickle. I mean, MySpace was popular once, and then along comes Facebook, and that dethroned it. And now young people are abandoning Facebook to the old people and moving on to, I think, first Instagram, now TikTok. I'm not sure where YouTube falls in the pantheon of young people's eyeballs, but you write that YouTube has outlasted all of these other platforms. To what do you attribute that success?
Yeah, I think there was a fascinating Pew study a month ago or so that said, you know, it talked about that rise of TikTok and how viewership for teens, it just pulled American teens into their spending less time on Facebook, more time on TikTok. Majority of them, like it was something like it was 66% said they used TikTok, 90% said they used YouTube. And so it's like replace cable TV. It's sort of in part of that, it's breadth of videos. Like they're, you know, TikTok is moving into this, but if you like something happens when your sync gets clogged, you're going to go to YouTube to figure out how to fix it. That's something you don't have. You don't go to Facebook and TikTok for that reason. I think their success in competing sort of as the entertainment platform has been because they've figured out a way to pay people, and it's not always steady and reliable, but it's there. And you're right that there are certain the cream of the crop that can make multi-million dollar careers, and that's been a major reason why it's been successful. I mean, what YouTube has done well, I think that they're very, you know, they're a computer science company, right? And so when's the last time you remember ever having to wait more than a millisecond for your YouTube video to load? Like they're just exceptionally good at making their product sort of seamless and just always work. I think that they've sacrificed, you know, many like content moderation and trust and safety issues. But they have excelled at least on like the technical aspects.
You share some amazing numbers in this book, and the statistics about who listens or who watches, who consumes YouTube are astounding. You put the fact that by 2019, more than a third of the world's internet population visited YouTube every day. That was in 2019. What is it now?
They don't share daily numbers from some of my reporting. I mean, it's so interesting. Like the stat that you talked about at the beginning of the program, that a billion hours a day of watching, that was something that YouTube set that goal in 2012, and it seemed like inconceivable. They had a joke that it was going to break the internet, and they didn't break the internet. They passed that goal. They haven't updated the numbers since 2016, as far as I know.
not only are people consuming a billion hours of content every day, people are uploading it to a degree that I can't fathom it. Just a couple of years ago, you say 450 hours of video was uploaded every minute, 24/7, to YouTube. It's got to have grown since then. So for context, you say that if you were to watch Lord of the Rings, a very long movie, 100 times in a row, you would still not have sat through the footage added to YouTube every 60 seconds. That means endless variety, much of it mediocre, I suppose, or worse, but it would also seem to mean that that it makes content policing practically impossible.
They're also leaning in really aggressively on podcasting now to try to compete with Spotify. And so they want to make it really easy for, you know, when we're done recording this, to just click a button and upload it to YouTube. I think, audio is a little bit easier to moderate than audio and visuals. Yes. I mean, there's a line in the book. I spoke to a senior engineer at YouTube that said, people think we have this great AI that can, you know, teach cars to drive itself. But sometimes we can't even identify what claims are being made in a video. It is an exceptionally hard problem. That is not to excuse the company. It's a problem that they created. But yes, policing it, they've made a lot of improvements and put a lot more resources into it, but it's almost unsolvable to be able to, in part because so much of the moderation and policing is subjective. It's not something that can be done by machines.
You also report on something that I don't know whether I find this disturbing or just inexplicable, but you report that a quarter of Americans rely on YouTube for news. As a journalist, Mark Bergen, you're a journalist. How does that make you feel?
I think it's inevitable. I think we haven't been paying enough attention to it. Like there are daily news shows on YouTube that have audience on par with CNN. And I think we should be scrutinizing it in the same way we scrutinize CNN. YouTube, you know, one thing that I found in the reporting is that at one point during the Arab Spring, this was a decade ago, YouTube actually worked with journalists, this newsroom called Storyful, to verify footage the authenticity of footage. They stopped doing that after a couple of years. Now they're sort of scrambling to sort out with the pandemic. You know, they're trying to they're raising what they call authoritative news sources like, you know, ABC and CNN, BBC. YouTube is effectively outsourcing this to media companies, in part because they created the system that anyone could kind of upload and be on par with a news media channel and give them expertise and credentials. So they've adjusted that system to try to solve that problem. I think it's something that, you know, there's a lot of news media that they still haven't solved the business model of video, right? Like it's not necessarily profitable to make unless you're Fox News or MSNBC or something. They've certainly changed the landscape of news consumptions in ways I don't think the company understands.
It would be very easy, and I'm sure it happens all the time, for any of the networks and the news networks to throw up individual stories that they have produced and aired on their own air onto YouTube so that people can see them on their own time. I'm sure they do that. I'm sure it's successful. But then there are these people who are completely unvetted and have no journalistic credentials, and you don't know where they get their sources, who their sources are, or how they write their stories. And they have nobody no editors making sure the content is accurate or even fair. And some of these people are not fair. Some of these are blatant partisans on both sides of the aisle. So what is the attraction? Why are people turning to YouTube to get their news and not CNN or Fox or CBS or ABC or name one?
I think the book talks about this a lot as like the onset of talk radio and like Rush Limbaugh and cable news and all those trends are sort of fracturing. Like people like to whatever side of the aisle, like they like to hear their own opinions and voices being echoed back. They like that what Rush Limbaugh did was sort of this talking to an audience and developing a relationship where they like trusted him. And I think that's the same dynamic that happens on YouTube. It just sort of took talk radio and cable TV and just went like several steps further. And so I think, and they're like, YouTube will make this argument. I think it's certainly part of it is accurate. Like there are, there are groups of people that for a variety of reasons, like kept out of mainstream media and kept out of broadcast, and what YouTube did is like, yeah, gave them a platform. And so they an audience there.
You say that YouTube is a new media as revolutionary as radio and TV. Would you say that's really an understatement? I mean, it took radio and television decades to get a critical mass of listeners and viewers and to become influential. I mean, television news didn't really dawn until the mid-60s. YouTube's influence happened in just a couple of years with a worldwide reach. Could that kind of influence have been anticipated by its founders, or even by Google for that matter? And now that the genie is out of the bottle, can it be controlled? Should it be controlled? Should it have any regulations on it?
Anticipate. I think, I mean, in some ways, I'm like, they certainly didn't anticipate the many directions that YouTube went. But also they intentionally create, like they went out, you know, when they wanted, Google took YouTube and it's like, they want to expand to as many markets as possible. Like they're not in China, but that's not for lack of trying. But they're pretty much everywhere else. And what YouTube did that Google didn't have to do, you know, Google basically just organizes the web's information on search. YouTube actually tried to convince people and went out intentionally, like, you should upload videos in your language. And so India is their biggest market, right? Which in the book talks about this a little bit, but like, they went out, you know, there's like dozens of languages there, and just all sorts of content moderation problems and that they haven't. And this is near markets where there's not a TV in every household. And so YouTube has basically just replaced television. I think, and it's, you know, it's not regulated the same way that TV is regulated, yeah, or radio. That's starting to change, but still there's a huge gap. And it doesn't seem like Congress is really moving quickly on addressing that.
Although YouTube TV is something else altogether different. In fact, it's a cable replacement. Right. In some places, you write that YouTube is television because they don't have television, traditional television in those countries. You wrote an article for Business Week where you say that YouTube went to war against terrorists, just not white nationalists. I didn't read it because of the paywall. So,
sorry.
That's okay. So you need to post that as a monologue on YouTube.
Worth paying for, but sure.
So flesh that out for us, please.
Yeah, this was, I think, a really something I stumbled on in my reporting that, like, you know, one of the critical turning points for YouTube was around a terror attack in London in 2017. And the company decided in this pretty remarkable way, like before that they had relatively hands-off, you know, they were like removing videos from ISIS and trying to identify, but they didn't want to necessarily, like, they had this example, like ISIS would start to, members of ISIS would upload videos just with health information or health tips. And there was this sort of macabre joke at the company. It's like, what if Osama bin Laden just uploaded a cooking channel? Like, do we want, you know, if it's just cooking advice, the company was like, well, we don't want to moderate that, or we don't want to take that down necessarily. That changed in 2017. And they took a very aggressive stance against what they call violent extremism. I think for a number of reasons, the company will say it's because the governments agree this is a terrorist and this is not. Governments don't agree with that with white nationalism and white supremacy. And yet there have been a series of attacks since the years. And I think the company has really struggled with that.
Mark Bergen, we have just scratched the surface of what you uncover about YouTube and all the intricacies of YouTube, which makes it worth reading. Like, comment, subscribe. Inside YouTube's chaotic rise to world domination. Thank you for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.